The following program is pre-recorded.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Newly released indicators gauge the mental health of Wisconsin high school students, and there are some discouraging trends.
The Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey found that in 2023, just over half of teens reported anxiety. One in three reported daily depression for 2 weeks or longer. One in five reported self-harm.
Here's Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underley at a news conference saying, we must do better.
As educators, as parents, as community leaders, as humans, we have the responsibility to confront this crisis head on. We have the knowledge and the resources to support our students as they attempt to wade through these challenging waters, many of them on their own.
That audio is courtesy of Wisconsin Eye. We're learning now about the survey's findings and why the mental health of young people has been declining for over a decade.
Linda Hall is the director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health. Linda, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me. This report that comes from the Department of Public Instruction is so important for us to have that this data that really helps us understand the well-being of the kids in Wisconsin. As you can tell from what you've already reported on, we've got a real mental health crisis going on right now.
Linda, you work on this issue day in and day out and working to improve youth mental health. What is your reaction to the 2023 survey results?
Well, frankly, we were hoping that some of these 10-year plus trends were going to be starting to go in the other direction. We've been seeing anxiety and depression increasing, kids' feeling of belonging, especially at school, decreasing for more than 10 years now. And we have more awareness of it since the pandemic. The pandemic maybe contributed some more to the trends, but we had really hoped to start seeing these trends turn around. At the same time, our office is really focused on making that happen, and I'd be happy to talk about that some more.
And I'm going to put a pin on that. I really want to hear some about these programs, what sounds promising. But I also want to, you mentioned the pandemic, and certainly the pandemic made things worse. The trend of more depression, anxiety among adolescents started about a decade before 2020, from 2009 to 2019, rates of major depressive disorder nearly doubled among adolescents. Can you talk about this increase and why it might have started before the pandemic?
Well, that's something we look at every day, and we're trying to put together all of the research that is going on out there and trying to create a really strong picture of that. What we know is that there are some things have been changing in how we live. First of all, smartphones came into existence, which means that all of us are relating to each other differently, and kids are using their phones a lot. We have some concerns about what that's actually doing to how their brains are developing, but that's a factor. We know that social media and the use of social media has increased. And that, especially for girls, there have been some really negative side effects of the content that they have been flooded with on the social media. Not that they're looking for, but what is being delivered to them. So there's that. And then with the pandemic, I think the biggest effect is that, that kids were separated from their friends, that all of us did a lot less of seeing people in person. And those in-person connections are so critical to how we feel, our well-being generally, and our mental well-being. So disrupting those connections was another factor that is contributing to all this. Kids tell us that it's those factors plus climate change, worries about gun violence, and political divisiveness.
The survey found, you mentioned this, that girls and LGBTQ plus youth are at the highest risk for depression, anxiety, and self-harm. What might be some of the causes of this disproportionate risk?
Well, I think I'd take you back to the issue that girls are being confronted constantly with images about being thinner, They're on social media. They're getting some negative messaging about themselves. They're also they're getting messages that they're not yet emotionally equipped to deal with. And so we really encourage people to, you know, if you're a parent, have a family media plan. Limit the time that your kids are on the social media. If you're a young person, do a little curating of what you're looking at on social media. Make sure that you're looking at positive things, things that help you. I think, and that's important for the LGBTQ kids. They, in many ways, are getting important connections through social media, but they need to, you know, focus on where it's a positive experience for them and not do it for too long. We're seeing kids are on for too many hours in a day, which takes away from their being outside, being physical, which is important for your well-being. And it's also taking away sleep. Kids are not getting this 8 hours of sleep that they used to get. And that's important for combating depression and for brain development.
Linda Hall is with us, directs the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, as we talk about the 2023 Wisconsin Youth Risk Behavior Survey, the results recently published in a report by the State Education Department. Linda, another troubling data point here in this report is about hunger and teens reporting not having their basic needs met. One in four students reported experiencing hunger due to a lack of food in their house during the past 30 days. How does hunger intersect with mental health?
Yes, that was a figure that I was not aware of and I was surprised by. I didn't realize it was that pervasive. But we do know that kids who are experiencing food insecurity, they're not able to function as well at school. They don't feel like they belong at school. And they're also being bullied more than other kids. So those kids have a lot of things in their way. And let me just say that when kids come to school and they're hungry or they're tired or they're depressed, they're not in a mindset to be able to learn. And so all these things are really important. And belonging at school is one of the things that gets kids to school. And when they get to school, if they're there with an open mind, fed and not depressed, they're more likely to learn and then move on to better careers and better wages after school.
Well, let's talk about the school setting. The current state budget includes spending $30 million for the Get Kids Ahead program, which helps schools provide the comprehensive mental health services. Are there still gaps in prevention in schools?
I would say that sustainable, more increased funding for school mental health is the most important thing that we need to do as a state. The $30 million that is in the budget this time is time-limited money that ends at the end of the biennium. It also was implemented in a way that was without a formula that really allows for the money to go equally and fairly to small schools as well as larger schools. It was a step forward in terms of moving it from a grant program to a per pupil program. But in that, there was a step was missed in order to make sure that rural schools didn't lose the money that they had. The reason that school mental health funding is so important is because few kids actually get mental health treatment, and 75% of those who get it are likely to get it at school. And there are lots of things that we can do at school to, you know, create an atmosphere where kids are going to thrive. So allowing that to happen, allowing mental health professionals to be there and to support our school social workers and school counselors to have the time to address kids' issues are very important things.
In this survey, there is the space for the teens to say what they wish. And there are some quotes here. One that stuck out to me is, "We are rapidly becoming the most depressed and zombied age group of all." That was really chilling. And I know your office is really trying to work on stronger connections among youth. What is showing promises with the programs that you're working on?
Yes, actually, that is our number one focus, is how can we increase kids' social connections and how can we help them feel more like they belong? Let me just say that one thing that we do have to recognize as we look at all these numbers is that there is a lot more freedom to talk about mental illness and about feelings. So we think that that is a factor in what's going on, that kids are more open to talking about how they're feeling and asking for help. But what we're hearing right now is that their needs for help are continuing to outpace what's available to help them. In terms of what we can do, we can all do things to make a difference in kids' lives. You know, just a 40-second interaction with a young person can reduce their anxiety. When it comes to being a supportive adult, one thing you can do is to just listen. Listen real attentively. And if you're a parent, listen. Don't try to fix things right away. Just hear where they're at and see how they're doing with their feelings. See how they're managing their stress. And then maybe work with them on some good coping skills. And as a parent, model good coping skills and model putting down your phone and interacting with a person face to face.
Linda, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. I appreciate you covering this topic. It's something that is very serious, but something that we can all contribute to making this a better place for our kids.
That is Linda Hall. She is the director of the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, talking with us about the state's 2023 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, why teens continue to struggle with mental health challenges. If you or someone you know is dealing with thoughts of suicide, call or text 988 to reach the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Again, it's three digits, 988.
Coming up, new research digs into the unique role played by women farm operators in Wisconsin. Two women share their experiences in the farm business.
I have, you know, a handful of women farmers who I go to not only for research, development, information, but as friends.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New research from UW-Madison finds an association between a higher number of women farmers and several benefits for local communities. That includes higher rates of new business formation, longer life expectancies, and lower poverty rates.
That study comes as women-operated farms nationwide have been increasing, jumping by more than 150% from 1978 to 2012.
That same research finds that women in general approach farming a little differently than men, with more emphasis on things like community connections, sustainability, and agritourism.
Last week, I talked to two women who operate farms here in the state about that research and their own experiences. Sarah Stelter is president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association and a farmer with over 800 acres of land. Her farm raises cattle and grows green beans, sweet corn, peas, corn, and soybeans. She's based in Wautoma. And Olivia Telshow is owner of Helene's Apple Orchard, a multi-generational 40-acre farm in Merrill. Olivia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Sarah, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
All right. Now, Sarah, we've got this research out here. The number of women-operated farms in America nearly tripled from 1978 through 2007. Of course, women have always worked on farms, but these are women-operated farms, they call them. And this research finds that women, in some cases, approach farming, farm management a little differently. Sarah, do you see that? Do you see either yourself or other women in farming doing things in any way different from their male counterparts?
I think in general, women tend to look at the larger picture to begin with. You know, frequently we are the ones that are raising our kids, and so we're concerned about our schools and we're looking into our community to see what's there. So I think in general, and again, I'm speaking in broad generalities because I know some men that are very good at this, but in general, I feel like the men are more focused directly on their particular farm and what they're doing and how they're doing it, as opposed to also looking at a little bit of a larger picture in terms of what's available in the community and what's going on in the community.
And same question for you, Olivia. Do you see any differences in the way women and men are approaching operating a farm?
I agree with Sarah. Women in general will form friendships with like-minded people. And, you know, my personal experience is that I have, you know, a handful of women farmers who I go to not only for research, development, information, but as friends. And it is a true friendship there as well.
Now, of course, everyone's story is different, and I want to hear each of your stories into what led you into farming, or maybe you started that way. Sarah, first, could you share your story?
Well, I didn't grow up on a farm. I started in the farming operation when I married into the family. Just through a couple of deaths in the family over a period of years, including my husband's and my brother-in-law's, I ended up deciding to continue operating the farm. So there was a really, really strict and long learning curve, which is still continuing today. So I also have a little bit different perspective than what some do who have been raised on a farm and grew up in the farming community.
And Sarah, I think a lot of people in that same position might not have made that same decision. They might have been ready to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to sell the land. I'm going to sell the operation. What led you to stay with it?
Well, we had worked so hard to get to where we were. We didn't have any huge outstanding debts at the time. And I really, really enjoyed what I was doing. I liked being able to be making decisions that would affect the farming or my farming operation, as well as looking at farming in general, and I wanted to become more involved in that. So I decided at that point to continue with my farming operation.
And Olivia, can you tell us your farm story?
Sure. I was raised on our apple orchard and came to fall in love with it. My parents did farmers market and direct marketing of fruits and vegetables in the 80s and 90s. And we ended up growing an agritourism venue. I went off to school, worked the corporate world for several years. And after my father had gotten sick in 2015, I came back and I purchased the farm. And that's something I'm really proud of, is that I actually purchased it from my parents, which has been a huge struggle for many women and just many people in general when it comes to parents having the farm first. But there is no turning back at this point, and it's the most rewarding thing I have ever done.
I want to stay with agritourism for a minute. That research, that Wisconsin research I mentioned, found that counties with a high share of women farm operators are more likely to have agritourism farms. Olivia, you mentioned you have some agritourism going on. What do you have going on in the orchard?
Back in the 80s and 90s, you know, we started with adding value-added products, using our own products to create another product from it. And those product lines have led us to doing farm-to-table dinners. We have a barn cellar with, you know, distilled products, craft beers, wines, all the activities that take people back to simpler times, you know, farm equipment, different games, wagon rides, field trips. You know, we do the sunflower field, we do the pumpkin patch. You know, we really want to educate the public on what life on a farm is in a way that the public wants to be educated.
Something else we see in this Wisconsin research, Olivia, is that women in farming seem to be more interested in sustainability in their agriculture than men in general. Of course, it may vary from person to person. That's, I think, part of your origin, even going back to your parents creating a bakery to reduce some of the waste from those windfall apples. How has sustainability factored into your orchard operation?
I always say that I farm differently than my parents did or my great-grandparents did on this farmstead. And it's really using technology and the science that is being researched and given to us, taught to us, to be able to make these important decisions. Women in general make decisions carefully. And I always say that with every decision I make on the farm, I'm making that carefully, because there is going to be influence and impactions to every decision that we make.
We're talking about some new research based here in Wisconsin, finding benefits for communities when there are more women-owned farms, women-operated farms. We have Sarah Stelter with us and Olivia Telsho. They're two women who are in farming and agriculture here in Wisconsin. Sarah, do you see any unique barriers, challenges for women either in agriculture or who want to get into farming?
I personally haven't run into a huge amount. There's been occasions where I know that if I, like, for instance, was at a meeting and suggested something, that if I were a man, it would have been taken differently than if I am then being a woman. I know there are sometimes false assumptions about what we farm or how we farm. And then in terms of just our knowledge base, I think there's some false assumptions about, well, you know, they can't know about that because they're women. But I personally haven't run into a lot of it. Probably, you know, I can count on two hands the amount of times that I was like overtly felt like I was being discriminated against. But what helped me out is I was able to take on a more active role in our farming operation. After my husband passed away, I was still farming with my brother-in-law, and I was the one that would contact equipment dealers or contract agents or whatever. I was the person out front. So they got to know me at the time that my brother-in-law passed away. So I didn't have a huge transition in that regard. But I know it's very much dependent upon, you know, everybody's individual experiences.
And Olivia, how about you? Your thoughts on maybe barriers that you have faced or that you see women facing in agriculture?
It used to affect me when people would ask to speak to my husband, or, you know, even I had a phone call last week where, you know, can I talk to the man? And that's not going to happen on this farm. I am the farmer. And if you don't want to work with me, then we're not going to work together. But like Sarah said, too, it's happened a handful of times, and you've just kind of learned to laugh it off. I've really tried to obtain as much information as I can and education, and, you know, really look at, you know, when I go to buy a piece of equipment, I go in knowing what that equipment's purpose is, you know, what the blueprints and schematics looks like on it. So I can ask questions and get a confident reply, or not, you know, a dumbed down reply from the salesman. But I definitely have learned that you know, it's hard to manage your family time. You know, you see on social media that family always comes first. And I would love to be able to say that 100% of the time, but the farm has priorities as well that have to get done on a time schedule that you can't ignore. So I've missed graduations, and I've, you know, missed classroom field trips. I've had to make those hard choices, which, you know, social media will make you feel like crud for doing that. But that's one barrier that I've had as a woman in farming who owns the farm.
Olivia, I think people who haven't worked in agriculture may think, oh, it's this timeless thing, unchanging, the old way of doing things. Just from some of what you've said already, you show the contrary. There's a lot of innovation and constantly staying up to date. Can you talk about the sort of innovations you've done with the orchard?
Well, we're talking through internet right now. And for us, little old Merrill, Wisconsin, we really didn't have internet service prior to COVID. So being able to use dependable internet in our tractors, in our computers, in our weather stations has really opened the door for us to be able to have not only knowledge real time, but the data and information from our sensors real time. And so we're able to use science, use the technology together, and then create, you know, a better product. But not only that, is we're creating a healthier product for the environment and also for ourselves.
And Sarah, what kind of cutting edge stuff, what are some of the changes in farming that you are constantly having to keep up with?
Well, I would echo pretty much what Olivia said, but we're also looking at, you know, constant, there's research that's coming out all the time about how we can better treat our land or with less inputs or maybe different inputs, just keeping up on what the research is providing us. The University of Wisconsin is supreme in doing that. It's just a constant learning environment, like Olivia has referred to before, that you between the technology stuff that's coming out, the new innovations, just the way that we're treating our land and treating our crops, it's just a constant ongoing thing to improve how we're doing and what we're doing.
That UW research I keep referring back to also found that women who are operating farms seem to be more likely to try to be in touch with their local community, which can mean a lot of different things in a variety of ways, than on average their male counterparts. Let's start with you, Olivia. Do you feel like your farm is in some way engaged in a community? Is this something you're trying to do more of?
Absolutely. Our farm is involved in our technical school culinary program here in town, and then also multiple state levels, and now internationally with the Agritourism Association as well. We need to be present. There is definitely a need for farms to be able to have their voice heard, but also be able to give back to the community. And I like to sit back and listen and hear what the community is saying and make sure that we're able to fill those needs. If it's something that we've been blessed with the ability to do, I need to make sure that we're filling that need.
And Sarah, you've already mentioned, you know, bringing people from the community onto your farm to educate them about what's going on. Anything else you would point toward when it comes to reaching out to the local area?
I think farmers are really good about being involved in farm organizations, but I think they also need to look outside farm organizations to be involved in generic community organizations. It's a really good way to informally educate folks and to answer questions and to just be present, like Olivia said, and then to be able to identify where the needs are and to be able to help out as much as possible.
Sarah, something I hear again and again when I talk to farmers is concern about what they call succession planning. When I retire, when I'm done working on the farm, who is going to take it up next? Is that something on your mind? Do you have something in the works, or is it an open question?
That's an open question for me. I have two adult children who are very happy in the professions they're in, and have chosen not to continue farming, although they do want to hold the land. So it's definitely a concern of mine, but it's It's to be determined, I guess. I've got some plans in place, but it's still like long range. You want to do the best you can for the land that you've got in order to continue with the caretaking that we're doing. So that is definitely something on not only my mind, but a lot of farmers' minds, whether they have kids who want to continue farming or not. So it's just an ongoing thing, ongoing open conversation, I guess.
And Olivia, is succession planning on your mind yet?
It is. And for me, when the first time I went through it with my parents, it was definitely the most emotional, hardest thing that I have ever done in my life. And it was on them, and it was on my siblings as well, who are not involved in the farm. So for my adult children, they have just recently graduated from college. They're starting their lives. And I have told them to go off, come back to me in 5 years, and let's talk at that point. But we are a fifth and sixth generation farm if they choose to come back. And I would love to have this farm stay within our family. But realistically, you know, it does have to be treated as somewhat of an investment. I invested in it when I bought my parents out. And at some point, I will need to retire as well. And that's where we're at right now.
Olivia, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Sarah, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Stalter is president of the Wisconsin Soybean Association and a farmer in Wautoma. And Olivia Telsho is the owner of Helene's Apple Orchard, a multi-generational farm in Merrill. Talked about their experiences as women farm operators in Wisconsin. New research from UW-Madison on that very topic. You can share your experiences if we've been talking about your life. Love to hear from you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin Today, take a tour of an underground labyrinth and meet the Wisconsin hobbyists who created it.
Pretty much every maze loop, I think there's three of them total, you go underneath yourself to be able to do a figure eight, because three-dimensional tunnels are far more confusing than two-dimensional tunnels.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about holiday magic.
Parents will go to great lengths to make sure that their kids have the perfect Christmas. Parents like Jan Larson of Eau Claire, who tells us about the quest she went on to find a particular bear for her son.
Mom, Dad, our youngest son, Dana's plaintive words travel from his bedroom down the hall and into the kitchen. I can't find Peef. These words are not particularly alarming on a clear summer day. As the ward of a loving but adventurous four-year-old, Peef might have burrowed under the covers for another 40 winks. Perhaps he has tucked himself behind the living room couch to initiate a favorite game of hide and seek. Or Peef could have retreated to the reading loft, where Dana will find him patiently waiting among the books and toys the two so often share together. For Peef is a magic bear whose fur is cut from cloth, and anywhere that Dana goes, well, Peef is sure to follow. I turn to assure the dark brown eyes filled with concern standing before me. Honey, don't worry, we'll find him. What I don't know is just how far Peef has gone and how far I will need to go to keep my promise. Peef is the progeny of two Christmas books. In book one, a lonely Santa makes Peef from the elves' favorite scraps of fabric. Peef is his constant companion, joining him on his sleigh to deliver toys every Christmas Eve. But by book two, Peef is doubting his purpose. He longs to join the other toys in their journey to the arms of a loving girl or boy. And so, on one snowy Christmas Eve, Santa bids Peef a tender goodbye and chooses one special little boy to love and cherish Peef forever. Dana knows he is that boy. He showers Peef with all the love and attention due a magic Christmas bear. They are now the constant companions, taking trips to the park, to the library, and to Grandma and Grandpa's house. But on this morning, and many mornings for weeks to follow, Peef is not burrowed under the covers, or tucked behind the couch, or waiting in the loft for his boy. My husband Lauren and I brace for the grief we feel sure will develop, and talk about ways to distract Dana. In the end, Dana comes up with his own coping mechanism. Peef, he announces some weeks after the bear's departure, is not lost. He missed Santa and went back to the North Pole for a visit. He'll be home for Christmas. Dana's storyline continues into late summer and early fall. He wonders aloud at what toys Peef and Santa might be creating in the workshop. Our parental strategy of waiting for Dana to forget Peef is not working. Our son's persistent narrative and innocent hope sends me searching. Could Peef be home for Christmas? I call vendors in Connecticut, scour eBay and collectors' websites, and tap into my mom network. It is December 23rd. I sit staring at the lights of the Christmas tree, hoping for inspiration. The books. I rummage through our collection of Christmas tales spread beneath the tree until I find what I need. I flip open the back cover. The author is from Minnesota. I snap open my laptop. A few clicks later, and I have him. A few more, and a number. Hello? You don't know me, but... The words come in a rush. I tell Tom Hegg, the man whose imagination has created Dana's dearest companion, of my search. When I finish, I can hear the smile behind his voice. Which one? I have boxes of them in the garage. Waves of relief wash over me. A full description of Peef guarantees he is just right. Via overnight express, Peef is coming home. I hide the box in our bedroom. Now home, how should Peef make his entrance? It is Lauren's idea. We tuck our youngest into bed and wait until his breaths are slow and deep. We nestle Peef into Dana's arms. It is the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature is stirring as the Larsons dream the sweetest of dreams. We wake to Christmas joy. Mom! Dad! Dana shouts with glee. It's Peef! He is back! And he's grown!
Jan Larson is a professor emeritus from the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin has its share of natural tunnels and caves, but in northwestern Wisconsin, a group of amateur excavators are constructing their own tunnel system through the area's plentiful sandstone.
Wisconsin Today producer Trevor Hook recently ventured into the labyrinth known as Sandland, and he takes us underground.
In western Wisconsin, about an hour from the Twin Cities, there's a road that splits to the north. As I get closer to my destination, I see a sign. Welcome to Sandland. Take only pictures, leave only footprints.
It's a place for people who never grew up to go crawl around and walk around and have a good time.
That's Eric Sutterlin, a contract mechanical engineer who lives outside the Twin Cities. Sandland is his creation. He bought a plot of land in Wisconsin back in 2011 and began what became his passion project. Today, Eric is out here with a couple of volunteers. One is fixing a part on the tractor that workers use to haul sand from the dig site down the hill. The tractor dates back to the 1960s.
I have a shoestring budget. Managing Sandland, paying for all of our expenses to keep digging. But what we more than make up for in terms of lack of funding is savvy friends who help us out as time permits.
Sandland has more attractions than I expected. Up the hill on the right is a decommissioned monorail from the Minnesota Zoo in the Twin Cities. Volunteers made the driver's cabin into something of a miniature museum. To the left, there's a treehouse one of Eric's collaborators built a few years back, but had to bring to ground level due to safety reasons. But the main attraction, the main reason I'm here, is down the hill straight ahead. The tunnels. One of the volunteers today is Dave Gerbeth. He's one of the chief diggers at Sandland. He takes what looks like large electric chisels with blades several inches wide and carves these tunnels underground.
So I kind of plan out what I'm thinking I'm doing in there, but it's all, nobody can see it because it's all in my head. But then they'll see my results as it plays out.
This has been Eric's passion project for around 13 years. He knows digging tunnels isn't everyone's cup of tea, but he says that it plays to his strengths.
You know, I absolutely respect people who have families, kids, houses. You know, it's great. But for my entire life, being born awkward and different and having this strong interest in maps, caves, geometry, even, you know, like road maps, average annual daily traffic maps. I love that sort of thing. You know, I love being immersed in my special interests, and I don't really have much interest in family, kids, house, all that stuff.
There are a few ways to enter the tunnels. There's a door marked as an exit, and then there's what he calls the intended visitor experience. I choose the latter. We put on knee pads and headlamps. Eric turns the generator on to provide power to Dave for tunnel chiseling later in the day. Faded green paint covers a wooden door with a few signs around it. The intended entrance to Sandland is small. It's only about 3 feet tall. The only way through is to crawl. The only light is from our headlamps. This tunnel system is made of Jordan sandstone, native to Wisconsin and states like Minnesota and Illinois throughout the upper Midwest. In the tunnels, it looks like horizontal layers of white, orange, and gray stone that speckles a bit under direct light. You may wonder about the safety of going through the tunnels at Sandland. It's certainly something I considered while on my hands and knees crawling through a hole into the side of a bluff.
I feel pretty confident that the risk of exploring our tunnels is very low compared to a lot of, you know, common activities like riding a bicycle. And I think for people who are mobile and outdoorsy, I think the reward is very, very much worth the risk.
After crawling for around 70 feet, I reached a fork in the road. One tunnel going left, one right. Because the entrance to Sandland isn't just a crawling tunnel, it's a crawling maze.
I deliberately designed the maze so that you can't see any other intersection from any given intersection, because that makes it more confusing and mysterious.
Okay, all right, I'll go right.
All right. Congratulations, you've taken the path less traveled because it's steeper. A lot of people go the easy way.
He's right. It's not the easy way. The sandstone is hard, even with knee pads and gloves. I'm carrying my microphone and audio recorder while we crawl, so I'm a bit slower than I'd like to be. After a few minutes, we're at another fork. I choose left, unsure if I'm about to enter one of the many loops Eric has made in this maze.
Pretty much every maze loop, I think there's three of them total, you go underneath yourself to be able to do a figure eight. Because three-dimensional tunnels are far more confusing than two-dimensional tunnels.
Yeah.
And so that's why we have all the ups and downs, just to make it confusing.
Right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, left. I'm crawling through section after section, and I'm getting hot. The temperature in the tunnel system is in the upper 40s, much warmer than above ground. I'm starting to sweat. The tunnel I'm in now is starting to look a little bit familiar. Or is it? Okay. Without spoiling, have I done a circle?
Would your visitor experience be better if I told you? Would you prefer to know, or would you prefer to have the mystery? I don't think it'll help you significantly.
Sure, then let me know.
You did go in a loop.
I did, okay.
After a few more minutes, I let Eric coach me through the maze, because I know there's more to see. Carving new tunnels in Sandland is a time-intensive process. The crawling maze alone took 5 years to complete. Down the ramp, we take a corner and emerge in a large circular area that Eric dubs the Donut Room.
It is a septagon. It's got basically one tunnel that's 5 feet wide, so it basically duplexes as a room where you can hang out and store things. And it's got 7 different segments, each of which are about 11 feet long. We deliberately made it a septagon as opposed to an octagon because people would come in here expecting an octagon. And so if they're counting the drifts that come off of it, drift is a word for a side tunnel in mining speak, but if they're counting the drifts, they'd get a little confused.
The donut room is essentially a hub area that connects the rest of Sandland together. Each side tunnel here curves too, leaving you with no idea what's around the corner. Some are deliberate dead ends, others lead to attractions that are under construction, like a 40-foot-long underground slide and a standing-level labyrinth called the Globe Maze. But the star of the show, the end goal of Sandland, was created by a contributor named Gabe. And it's one of the most Wisconsin things I've ever heard of.
This is Gabe's bar. Everything was designed and dug and created by Gabe. Gabe identified, you know, Dave and I are creating a lot of places you can move through, but we aren't really creating anywhere as like a place to hang out and move to.
The bar is a bit snug at around 15 feet long, with nearly everything carved directly out of sandstone. The bar on the left, the two booths and accompanying tables on the right are all solid sandstone. The sand grains throughout the tunnels here are bigger, more coarse than the sand you'd run into on a beach. Around the corner from the bar, before we head back outside, Eric and I hear a sound from a nearby tunnel. It's what Eric dubs the sound of progress. Eric's friend Dave is digging another section of tunnel, and it's time for Eric to take out a wagon full of sand.
How many wagons do you think we'll get in one day?
It all, you know, like my statistics professor at UW-Madison said, it all depends. You know, that's a really easy, quick place to get sand from. Most of the places, like back in the Globe Maze, if it's just Dave and I, we'd be lucky to get 15 in a good day.
After a short trek, Eric and I emerge from the lowest entrance to the tunnels. As he dumps the sand onto a fenced-in pile on the side of the ravine, I realize the sun's about to set. I've been in the caves for at least 3 hours. Time in Sandland is measured in years. Eric and his colleagues make plans for what they want to sculpt underground 5, 10, and even 20 years in advance. But Dave, the person who digs the most at Sandland, is 72 years old. Both Dave and Eric say they know that Dave might only have a few years of digging left in him at the complex. Eric himself is 44 years old and has early signs of kneecap arthritis from his years of cave exploration. But Eric is thinking much larger than the two of them for the future of Sandland.
I'm the sole member of our LLC, and in the long run, once I pass, it'll be a group of our top contributors because they are the people that can be most trusted to stay true to our mission and not try to, for example, divert it for profit.
Keeping true to that mission is important for Eric and his colleagues because despite this tour, despite how generous Eric was with his time for me, Sandland isn't open to the general public, but, in Eric's words, they do welcome visitors and donations, and they hope to well into the future.
If Sandland was only going to last 30 years, we wouldn't be digging at all because, you know, that wouldn't be much benefit for our efforts. But since it's likely to last 1,000 years and hopefully thousands, if not tens of thousands, if not more, people will get to crawl through and have this unique experience that they'll remember for the rest of their lives. You know, that's a huge, huge motivation to keep on digging and make it as exciting as we can.
For Wisconsin Today, I'm Trevor Hook.
Thanks to Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful for technical direction on that piece. You can read more about Sandland and see pictures at WPR.org.
Looking back on 2024 and inviting you to share some of your favorite memories from the year. And today the category is the best outdoor experience you had in the state.
That could be a great hike at a state park or a time on a boat or hunting season or a stroll in the neighborhood or skiing, such as water skiing or snow skiing.
Or maybe it's an event, an outdoor festival, concert, sporting event at a pro stadium or a local park.
Tell us about your best time in the outdoors this year. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or call or text us at 888-642-0232 to share your story. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.